Welcome to the Change Society podcast. And today, my guest is Mark Alcock, a successful fintech executive and entrepreneur who is currently CIO and founding partner at 10X Banking, amongst other portfolio activities. So today, Mark, welcome. I know you're here in a personal capacity to discuss technology and digital transformation going through some experiences and advice and knowledge around how to potentially persuade boards to be comfortable about this transition and the associated benefits. But first, looking at your profile and knowing you for a couple of years now, you've got a very interesting and varied portfolio career as a fintech executive and entrepreneur. So quick intro from you and just run us through some of the things you've been up to.
Great. Thanks, Pat. And thanks for having me today. So great to be here. So I've had quite an interesting career, and it still remains interesting, which is good. I broadly spent the first 10 years of my career working for Tier 1 banks. So I started with Citibank Private Bank in my early 20s and was given a great opportunity to run one of the first ever projects to create a core banking platform using resources based in India. In those days, there wasn't really a common term around outsourcing, and that wasn't sort of an understood thing. This was a wholly owned subsidiary we'd set up within Citibank to enable us to create software from Mumbai, or Bombay as it was at the time. And so I had the opportunity to run that project of about 100 people, ran that from London to create this platform. And it was a really groundbreaking, project. And I think it really helped me to understand the challenges around delivering in Tier 1 environments at scale. This platform later went out to become a global platform, and in its future life was actually acquired by Oracle for about $900 million when we spun out the subsidiary. So it was a very successful, long-term journey that Citibank set out on. After that, I was headhunted and joined Credit Suisse in their derivatives business, stayed there a couple of years. Again, that was very different culture, very different environment, also very demanding. Again, some groundbreaking stuff was done there around derivative risk assessment in real time. And subsequent to that, I was again headhunted to join JP Morgan, who'd started a new initiative to create a global platform to manage the post-trade investment activities. I stayed with JP Morgan for about 5.5 years. Culminating in a stint based in New York, working with the Bank of New York and others to do what was the first time industry initiative around applying some Silicon Valley technology to the needs of financial messaging, which is a term really describing payments and much more beside. And I think it was the culmination of that experience which led me to, when I returned to Europe, I thought I've got some unique experiences here. And I sort of almost accidentally then began the second part of my career, which was, becoming a consultant. And as a result of that work, picked up a series of assignments, and these assignments then grew in scale from being just me to me plus a few to me plus larger teams. Again, working for Tier 1 banks, the likes of ING, Lloyds, some major banks of equivalent stature, Tier 1 stature in the Middle East, the largest bank in the UAE, National Bank of Abu Dhabi, and so on and so forth. And I ended up staying in the Middle East for about 9 or 10 years, and then finally returned to Europe, to UK, in 2010. Where I was offered the opportunity to run a program as the program director for Visa as part of their digital transformation to create a product known as the Visa Digital Wallet, which was an attempt by Visa to compete with PayPal. And that was a huge investment, about £75 million, €87 million. And I think through those experiences, you really develop you know, a whole range of skills in terms of understanding stakeholders, understanding the business dimension, understanding the technology that can be applied to create the right solutions. And it's been a really good journey.
Fantastic. How do you deliver in tier one investment banks? I mean, looking through your achievements, there's some, you know, big heavyweight stuff that's really made the difference for organisations and boards. Yeah, how do you get the cut through in such large organisations?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think what I've always felt is that first you've got to start by creating a compelling vision. You know, you've got to approach, say, an existing challenge or a problem in a new way where you can sort of think about it innovatively. You know, how can you solve a problem that everybody recognises as a problem, but maybe the solutions that have been on offer previously are not that attractive or are too costly or too time-consuming or too risky. So I've tended to sort of try and put a lot of effort in at the very beginning, focusing on articulating what the new way could be, and then coalesce and get stakeholders to support and buy into that. That takes quite a good chunk of time to do that in my experience. But if you do that, if you get that buy-in, make the effort to get people bought into the vision so they come on the journey with you, I found that that's a more effective way of working. It certainly worked quite well for me in terms of the various things that I've done.
So can you talk us through one particular example where you've articulated you know, an outcome or a target state or a transformation for a board, how you got them aligned and bought into the mission and then delivered it for them and with them, and what were the associated benefits to that particular business? Because, you know, with transformation, it kind of, you know, starts and ends with, you know, the alignment engagement from board. And I know that a lot of people in our network, you know, sometimes, you know, have frustrations with, you know, board being engaged for 3, 6, 9 months and then losing sort of the appetite. So it'd be interesting to get your, you know, one example from.
I suppose, I've got quite a few examples. One example that springs to mind, I was working for Barclays and assigned to Barclay Card. And Barclays has been quite public about its commitment to transform itself digitally. And obviously in becoming digital, and that, you know, means different things to different people, but you have to really have a really smart, efficient, effective way to identify customers digitally. That means, you know, you've got to be able to know who you're dealing with without requiring them to visit branches, without requiring them to send in paper documents. So in the era of digital identity management or digital registration or onboarding, various phrases used to describe the process of getting, you know, somebody who isn't a customer to become a customer. And that's got a number of challenges, not only in terms of doing that in accordance with the regulations to satisfy and protect the bank from issues, but also how do you do that in a way that's compelling and easy for customers, you know, to go through those steps, because it's obviously a key challenge to get customers on board quickly and painlessly and in a frictionless way. But also the identification and registration of customers is subject to some fairly fast-paced, as fast-paced as regulations are in financial services, some fast-paced changes around using stronger authentication methods because of obviously perceived worries by the regulator around fraud. So how do you get somebody to register using their face or their voice, the so-called biometric ways of registering? Now, if you think about that, at one level, it's quite deeply technical. On another level, it's completely aligned to the business because it's about getting customers on board. But there are some quite significant hurdles to get through in terms of how do you convey, you know, the strengths and merits of different biometric mechanisms to an exec committee, you know, an exco. And again, that's where, you know, I've had to put a lot of work in with the teams that I've been leading to make sure that we articulate things in a clear and compelling way that can demonstrate direct benefits from a business point of view. In terms of making it easy to onboard customers and retain them and also keep the bank secure and also protect the customers as well, because obviously the other side of the rigor that banks have to go through to identify customers is also about protecting the customer's own information in this world of cyber threats and everything else. You know, so lots of dimensions to look at. And again, you know, the approach that I took there was to try and come up with a compelling vision that would be a way for, you know, the bank to register customers digitally, allowing customers to use a choice of ways that they might wish to register with. So people that have got, you know, high-end phones that have got sufficient, you know, camera technology on them, you know, would be able to use their face as a means of, you know, recognition. Others that might not have those, you know, wouldn't be able to use that, but they could use an alternate option. So what I did there, I conceived a way whereby a whole range of different customers across different segments and a whole range of different divisions across the bank could commit to and support the creation of a common way to, you know, to identify customers, yeah. Right? Now, that required crossing of quite a few divisional lines. So, you know, it was a case of identifying, you know, working through the network, mapping the stakeholders out, meeting with those stakeholders one-to-one, trying to apply very much a personal influence to get their commitment and support to participate. And through that process, we found some 30-plus teams that have been working away independently, all on a similar thing. And if you think about that from a board point of view, which obviously we used as part of the, you know, the sell and the pitch to the Exco, if you sort of, you know, cumulatively assess all that cost of all those individual teams broadly doing the same thing, then there's an immediate benefit and an immediate save when you think about, let's do it once, but do it for everybody. But again, because of the ways that, you know, large financial institutions are structured, it's also then quite novel and new, because you have to then figure out how could you get the contribution from different parts of the company with different, you know, budget pots and yep. different processes and cycles and drivers and objectives and timeframes.
Right? So complex.
It's quite complex. Yeah. But quite rewarding when you get that buy-in. You know, when you move from a place of finding these 30 disparate teams, actually to a place then where willingly showing up for meetings to discuss a new common approach, were participants from most of those teams.
And do you co-create quite a bit of your vision and plan and, you know, delivery framework with everyone that's involved to get a bit of equity from them?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really key to succeeding in that sort of, you know, environment.
Yeah.
Because the needs are different as well. You know, if you look at, say, a card business compared to an online banking business to, a business banking or a wealth management unit, the range of ways that people would need to identify themselves are quite different. Mm. So you have to factor those in.
Yeah.
And obviously, each of these separate areas, separate units, separate divisions, will have already invested quite a lot of effort themselves. So in a way, you've got to find a way to sort of harness and use what they've already done, not to sort of throw it away. Because I think if you try to go in with an approach saying, look, you know, ignore everything that you've done before, then you get all the resistance factors as part of, you know, part of the change management process. Yeah. So,
yeah. Okay. Yeah. So big, complex, tier one delivery experience. Mm. Now, if we look at the sort of portfolio part of your journey, so the entrepreneur part of your journey, can you talk us through from when you went from tier one, first stepping into, you know, your first entrepreneurial experience, and how that's brought you to where you are today?
Because,
you know, you've got some great achievements under your belt.
Thank you, So I think that really began for me when I returned, when I left JP Morgan in New York, end of 1999. Came back to the UK and decided to set up my own consulting business. You know, I had quite a decent sized house at the time. I put aside the top floor of the house to use as an office. So I had sort of some, you know, idea that it would grow to a reasonable size, but I wasn't sure. And I chose to leave JP Morgan without having anything lined up. That was just my choice. I thought, you know, I've reached a point now.
Gutsy. Where
it was quite gutsy.
And was that just to give yourself the time to, the thinking time to cook? Because that really resonates with me. I mean, I was fully utilized 100% in my old world, fully utilized in meeting rooms 100% in my old world. And I had this idea in my head, and I did something similar where I just wanted to make a clean break and give myself the time to bring the idea out. I mean, did you do something similar?
It was, I think, part of that. But I think for me, you know, what drives me is almost creating a little bit of stress and pressure.
Yeah.
So I think the fact that I made that leap.
The mortgage monkey.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we've all got commitments.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, nothing more sharper every morning than the mortgage monkey to get something.
So I think it was a combination of those sort of factors. You know, a little bit of time to think. The realization that what I was doing was genuinely new and novel, and I sort of at that time got some, you know, acquired some experiences which I just thought would naturally flow from, you know, the US into Europe and elsewhere, and nobody else was doing that sort of thing at the time, you know, in Europe. So and then just putting myself into a place where there was almost no turning back, which is, I think, probably quite a personal trait for me. Mm. I need to feel the pressure and stress in order to get myself fired up and motivated.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. So I know when we spoke recently, and it was a great experience, you know, what you're up to at the moment, and we were discussing about, you know, some of the pressures that boards are facing today at the moment to transform, you know, and that sort of old revenue model versus the innovation dilemma. And, you know, just the sheer access to new technologies and, you know, new digital technologies and new ways of working. So talk to me about where you see the world. Now, we talked about cloud and the opportunities that that can present to boards and present to companies in that move to the new world. But talk to us about, you know, how you would advise boards on that journey and, you know, that transition to the new world, the risks associated, but the benefits and the ultimate prize for them if they're...
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose the catalyst for that, Pat, would really be around the work I did with Anthony Jenkins at 10X. Anthony, as, you know, many people will recognise, was the group CEO of Barclays. And I also was a director for a time at Barclays, and while Anthony was there. And, you know, Anthony was a very keen advocate of the benefit of technology. He could see, I think, possibly slightly ahead of time, how technology could be used to transform the industry, not only in terms of the, you know, the banks themselves, but also the lives of customers. And he was an absolute advocate for that. When he himself left Barclays, you know, he took sort of time out to you know, go to Silicon Valley and just to get slightly deeper into the technologies. And then at some point on his journey, he approached me through another contact he'd been working with to explore what could be done to transform banking. And that was another... So an interesting opportunity, also an entrepreneurial opportunity, because, you know, Anthony set up a small serviced office. There were, you know, four desks in the office. We occupied two of them. And he literally gave us a blank sheet of paper. And said, this is the industry. You guys recognize, you know, the challenges in the industry. What could be done? So we set about sort of having to think about how we could apply technology to solve a lot of the pain points within the industry, and how, if you think about, you know, core banking platforms, once implemented, these platforms generally tend to run for 10 to 15 years, right? In some cases longer. So we knew that in thinking about transformation, we had to think ahead, and I coined a phrase, you know, thinking for the decade ahead. And we had to think, what would that look like? What is the shape of the industry going to look like? And I think we could see and recognise early signs that the digital future, the transformation that needs to come about and will come about in the industry will involve the embracing and integrating with a number of digital service providers from outside of the bank. So, you know, the old banking model was very much put everything inside the bank, build a fortress around it, you know, spend a lot of money on systems and supplier contracts, etc., end up with hundreds, in some cases thousands, of systems, and mostly within the walls of the bank. The future, I think, is very much about embracing the ecosystem. And people use that word, or marketplaces, but essentially it's about bringing the solutions that customers want together by leveraging a lot of third parties and external participants. So a key part of that is around being able to, you know, integrate with those players with APIs and other things. Again, this is not really something that banks have traditionally done. Now, that's a big challenge in and of itself. But we also recognize that the cloud was both a great threat and also an opportunity for banks. Because if you look at a traditional, you know, bank of some size, you usually find that they've invested a huge amount of capital in setting up multiple data centers, you know, with a lot of computing power in them. And quite often a lot of that computing power is not used because it's there in case, you know, a failure, in case of disaster, or in case of an occasional spike in demand. So if you look at the CapEx aspect of that, which is a phenomenal amount of money, because it's not only the, you know, the costs of the real estate, you know, where these data centers are located have to be super secure, the equipment within them, the teams that need to keep them maintained, the supplier contracts that go around it. So if you roll all that up, it's a huge amount of cost. And banks generally are facing quite a lot of pressure these days in terms of the cost-to-income ratio. And boards have a desire, as, you know, most boards in the banking world have a desire to try and reduce the cost-to-income ratio significantly. So there's a clear opportunity there, but how do you get to that? You know, so a key part of how you get to that is thinking about using the cloud, because with the cloud, and again, most business executives will understand this, that you can actually replace the need for a lot of that redundant, latent, you know, computing power that's sitting there. So there's an immediate sort of cost-benefit conversation that can be started, rather than one which focuses immediately on the technology itself. Usually after that, then, you know, boards will rightly have concerns about, is it secure? Is it scalable? Is it reliable? So the approach I took there was to study all the available options, and, you know, looking at Microsoft, Google, Amazon Web Services, and other things, and possibly, you know, thinking about it entrepreneurially, but also thinking about it like a tier one would think about it, I tried to identify and highlight what would be the aspects of each of those potential service offerings that would make them attractive or possibly not attractive to ExCos and boards. So, for example, some of the cloud providers at the time we were looking at them couldn't guarantee that the data would stay within the European Union, within the European region. And obviously there are laws and requirements around data protection. Amazon was able to offer that because their data centers were located in Dublin, Frankfurt, and London. And we could control very much, you know, keeping the information there. So it was really about constantly going through and thinking, okay, what's the business concern on this? I.e., we need to have protection and sovereignty or controls around data, and which of the providers could then support that, and how technically, you know, robust were they at supporting that? We had to get into aspects around what would the FCA think about using the cloud. Again, and we're blessed in the UK with a very progressive, forward-looking FCA. There's still obviously processes and procedures to be followed to get their approval, but the chief executive and down within the FCA have been very welcoming of and supporting of both fintech initiatives, as well as recognising the role that new technologies can play. Yep. So that's a benefit. Again, that's got to be articulated because it's not universally understood. by boards and senior execs.
And that's what I was going to say, because on my travels, when I catch up with some of the financial services executives that we're helping, they're probably 80% of the time sort of tied up in reg tech. Mm. So, I mean, do you feel it's something that needs to improve? Because yeah. I know like several that, you know, are struggling with that sort of cloud, you know, agenda of what can we fully adopt versus not, and the sort of hybrid models that have been put into place at the moment. So what's your advice to those that, you know, might need to, you know, make that journey to know what you know?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I think firstly I'd say, you know, have some courage, embrace it. The solutions that you need to create can be created, but you almost need to have the, you know, the commitment and the belief to go with that, go on that journey, force that through, because the companies such as, you know, the cloud, the major cloud providers are going to succeed or not based on how well they respond to the needs of the customers in the market. So actually, if you look at the pace of change in those cloud service providers, it's phenomenal. I mean, Amazon has now got, you know, 100 plus services. Mm-hmm. You know, if you went back a few years, there'd be a, you know, many fewer services available. You know, it was largely around, you know, some tin, some servers, some equipment, maybe some database technology. But nowadays, you've got a whole breadth of services that they've brought on board because they clearly see the opportunity is there if they can respond to the needs of customers. So I think very rapidly, perhaps more rapidly than the usual change cycles in banks, cloud infrastructure players are evolving, you know, more quickly and adding.
Okay.
So I think by the time, you know, a bank gets to the place where it needs something, it will probably be there.
Okay.
And also, they're, you know, these vendors are open, if approached in the right way, to strategic conversations. They actually welcome that, and I've certainly found that with conversations, you know, we had with them.
And some of the things I hear on my journey is, you know, you've got organisations that want to change and they want to look at fresh services, but boards, for whatever reason, whether it's a decision being made historically or procurement's been involved, have got an element of vendor lock-in. Any advice on how to make that move from some, you know, an environment where there's heavy vendor lock-in to looking at, you know, fresher suppliers that can harness some of the new services that are coming through that, you know, boards and executives have access to now?
Yeah. I think, you know, there are a few approaches. One approach I particularly like is to, in parallel with the existing environment, to create a small, initially small-scale new environment, you know, to use a more of an agile way of working, a proof of concept based approach, an experimentation based approach, to create almost like a tangible proof point that can be compared and contrasted with the existing environment. I think that's a good way to go. And also, you know, let's not forget the vendors themselves, the ones that have those lock-in arrangements, also see the future. So there may actually be ways to nurture and nudge that conversation, that relationship, over towards a more of a cloud-based solution. Because I think, you know, most people will generally see that, you know, in the future, all computing will become, you know, cloud-based rather than being on-premise.
Yeah. Okay. And you mentioned this kind of concept of, you know, like a pilot or a proof of concept or, you know, a project or a mission in a parallel universe. Do you do that away from the sort of current operating model and old revenue models, or would you put it in that? You know, do you separate it, or have you done both?
Yeah, I think I've applied both, and I think it depends. It's a little bit depending on the stage of the cultural transformation journey, perhaps, that companies are at. So those that have recognised the need to identify new ways of working in that scenario, obviously do it as part of the existing, you know, business. For perhaps those that need some help and encouragement, persuasion along the way, then I think setting up a pilot, you know, is a good way to go, so that you can do that at least in a way that is, you know, low cost in terms of, you know, it doesn't require a huge amount of approval at board level to sign off something, but creating really a sort of a a lighthouse initiative or a pathway initiative to show the benefits and do that in a non-threatening way initially to get people positive about the change opportunity.
And does that land particularly well with more sort of risk-averse boards? That
I think so.
They actually need some cultural change themselves to make more risk, not riskier decisions, but just different decisions.
Different decisions, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And what else would you recommend to those types of board members? Because that's a really good approach that we advocate and we actually do for our clients. But what other?
I think to the extent possible, try and expose yourselves to others in the industry and also not necessarily the same industry. So the great thing about the amount of information available these days is that you can quite easily identify who are the digital leaders in different sectors. And at the heart of it, there's some common denominator-ish, lessons, learnings, opportunities there that can be applied, I think. So, you might want to study, players like Zara and go, well, okay, what's the relevance of that, say, to financial services? But actually, if you look at how they've automated and streamlined and made massively efficient their supply chain, they've essentially figured out a way to go from spotting demand to then delivering against that demand. And I think the same conceptual approach as part of a change process can be applied to customers. Ultimately, in the banking sector, financial services sector, wouldn't it be an amazing result if through transformation and rethinking, customers could actually design the products that they want and then products become uniquely tailored to an individual? That's surely going to create an amazing loyalty and buy-in from that customer base. Right? These things are possible now through technology, and because the cost dynamics have changed, meaning these technologies are less costly than they used to be, and you can assemble them through working with this ecosystem more quickly. That I think is a huge opportunity for forward-looking boards to seize.
So do you see that as the now and the future, co-creating with customers, co-creating with your business?
Yeah, absolutely.
And sort of the decentralisation, more of the hierarchical model.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you look at the the old model, we used to spend a huge amount of time gathering requirements, documenting them, assembling lists of potential suppliers, initiating procurement processes, etc., etc. And I've certainly seen projects in the past where you could spend years just going through the process of selection. At the end of that selection process, you still then have to go into the implementation phase. And in that implementation phase, the ground reality hits you. Oh, it wasn't quite how we'd understood things to be. So I think co-creation, collaboration is much more effective, because what is more likely to be the result is that companies will actually get exactly what they want through that that approach. Now, it does require a change in ways of working. It requires a change in team structure. It requires a more dynamic, more fluid approach in terms of how resources are applied, clearly. But I think the benefits and the rewards are phenomenal.
So, quick question for you. If we transport both of us into sort of, 2025, 2030, what do you think a future organisation design is going to look like for a FTSE?
Wow. So I think it will be a slimmed down organization where there's a smaller central core. It will probably use lots of partners and on demand teams, resources that can be assembled for specific initiatives. And then once that's finished, the team will stand down and move on perhaps to other things. So I think it will be a small centralized core with a much more dynamic sort of set of satellite structures around that will be, less rigid and, just more flexible, more dynamic.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, I could ask you absolutely loads of questions. I think I've only got time for maybe two more, because Canham's looking at me, urging us on for our sort of 40 to 45 minute sort of cap that we like to use on this show. So just a couple of practical questions for you towards the end, if that's okay.
Sure.
So clearly you've got a very interesting journey that you've had throughout your life in both sort of, you know, the business world. So, you know, tier one banking executive, entrepreneur, you know, founding member of a current and future success story. What top three tips or experience would you like to share with our listeners that, you know, they might find of benefit when, you know, potentially, you know, leading programs, you know, being an executive and taking boards on a journey? Anything practical that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Yeah, I think I'd probably say, you know, firstly, be bold, think big. So things are, especially in the, you know, the world that we live in, technology is changing at such a fast rate, and there's solutions around the corner for most problems. So think big and bold, you know, remove the constraints to the thinking. I think figure out ways to embrace with a diverse range of opinions from outside the firm as well as inside. There's huge amount of talent in large firms as well as, you know, externals, and I think putting those two things together it can be really powerful. I guess, you know, try and have fun. I mean, it's not easy to do something that's quite big and transformational. There are a lot of challenges along the way, but develop a series of personal and team, you know, reserves that will enable people to just go through, you know, the ups and the downs that will occur, you know, through any of these change cycles would be my initial thoughts.
Gold. And finally, I mean, I've got a personal mission to sort of change the way the world engages with interims. You know, I think my and our business wants to, you know, support people that are looking for a portfolio career. And I speak to so many people who want a portfolio career. They want that diversity. But sometimes they are struggling with making that first step. So could you finish off the show with maybe two or three tips for anyone that might be listening to this thinking, I fancy a move into becoming an entrepreneur. I'd love to, you know, pick up an NED or a trusteeship or maybe be involved in a startup. But, you know, what would you share to them about maybe three things to consider or three tips about that move from, you know, an executive to a portfolio journey?
Yeah, yeah. So I think, you know, if you're making that journey, then obviously, to the extent you can, try to plan for it. I think, you know, try and create a bit of a financial cushion, because in making the transition, it can take a period of time. And people say getting a new venture business thought off the ground can take 9 to 12 months, you know, sometimes longer. So I think, you know, set yourselves up to be able to go through that journey without having to worry about, you know, the mortgage, for example. Mm. You know, not everybody can do that, but, you know, where possible, I think try to do that. Secondly, I think, you know, get into and form associations with groups, suppliers, you know, build the relationships with a network. I mean, active relationship building, so that when you are just about to make the transition, you may actually find that there's somebody from that network who could give you that first helping step. You know, maybe the road for somebody to full-blown entrepreneurialism might be initially an interim assignment or something of that nature. You know, those sort of assignments can be lucrative too. And I think the other thing I would say is get used to a bit of what I refer to as a feast and famine model, which is, you know, you might pick up an assignment for 6 months and then have a period of 3 months and then another assignment. And I think, you know, so long as you can sustain yourself through that period, those gaps, those down periods, if you want to call them that, could actually be great opportunities to just keep track of what's going on in the markets and look ahead and try always to be ahead of the curve.
I think some of the most successful interims that I know use that fallow period for learning, for network building, and they don't stress out about being out of work because they've put some money aside. And I know it's not for everyone, but, you know, it can be quite nice to have periods of your year where you're away from the coalface.
It's quite hard. Often in a full-time role, quite often you don't get that opportunity, right? Yeah. It's just, you know, it becomes a daily routine and you don't have that opportunity. But I think that's one of the rewarding things with a portfolio approach or an interim opportunities to be able to do that.
Cool. Well, Mark, thanks for coming on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure to spend some time with you. Wish you all the best with your current and future activities, and I think you've definitely earned your pint in the King's Arms.
Okay. So, cheers,
Ben. Thanks very much for being on the show.
My pleasure.